It's the afternoon of February 1st, 1960. Four well-dressed black college students walk together down South Elm Street in Greensboro, North Carolina. Around 4:30, they enter the F.W. Woolworth department store, linger in the aisles, buy a few minor items. Then they move to the long lunch counter. It's an area of swiveling padded seats with those shiny chrome backs. These men, Ezell Blair, Franklin McCain, David, Joe McNeil, David Richmond, calmly and with steady dignity, then sit down. Years later, Franklin McCain, who was called the instigator, offered his personal testimony on that moment. 15 seconds after sitting down, I had a wonderful feeling. I had a feeling of liberation, of restored manhood. I felt a natural high. I felt almost invincible. Mind you, I was just sitting on a dumb stool. Now, almost six decades later, we know what Franklin McCain and his three friends could have never imagined. That one simple act of just sitting became a potent pebble thrown into the serene water of white supremacy. In time, it would broaden and deepen and strengthen, and it would roll down like the waters of a mighty stream. By August of the next year, 70,000 people have participated in the sit-ins, resulting in over 3,000 arrests. There, those four sat like trees planted beside the water, and they would not be moved. Sitting because Ezell Blair's mother insisted that it be so, sitting in clothes like you're going to church. So spiritually grounded that they acted and spoke from a place of uncompromising love. Clear that they would meet the full force of white supremacy with the soul force of nonviolent resistance. Just sitting. Just sitting. Historian Clive Webb, in an essay analyzing the white reaction to the sit-ins, cites a 1961 poll in which 84% of the respondents expressed opposition to both the tactics and the aims of the protesters engaged in the sit-in. Another poll underscored their judgment on these acts. Only 34% of those who called themselves integrationists and a scant 17% of self-described racial moderates regarded the form of protest as legitimate. Do you hear what I just said? Only 34% of those who describe themselves as integrationists and a scant 17% of those who describe themselves as racial moderates regarded the sit-ins as a legitimate form of protest. Just sitting atop a stool in one Sunday best, determined to meet every indignity, each emotional and physical threat with nonviolence in order to challenge white supremacy, is a tactic and is an aim that is not an appropriate form of protest. Oh, some of the more generous critics called it youthful exuberance. Some assessed it as ignorance. But according to one poll, just 12% were willing to believe that these demonstrators really were motivated by a desire for racial equality. Legislators got in on the act, digging up old statutes, dreaming up new ways to give the police even more power, dragging out the old cudgel of states' rights, defending the privileges of businesses to serve and not serve whomever they wish. Retaliating against the colleges, regarded as the recruiting grounds by forcing the dismissal of professors and the expulsion of students. When congressmen called the peaceful sit-ins a planned and concerted effort to agitate and create dissension to the point of violence, dismissing the demonstrations as publicity stunts. Another said those engaged in the sit-ins conspired to start a race riot of terrible proportion. Many of us have seen the images, the taunts, the dehumanization, the mental and physical abuse, and to be sure, the most virulent, violent strain of racial of white supremacists were mobilized against the sit-in movement. The Ku Klux Klan, the White Citizens Council, the police, racist court judges. But it is telling that the system of white supremacy was also upheld by those concerned that this sort of unseemly thing would be bad for business. They argued, according to Clive Webb, that slow and deliberate policies would accomplish change better than the impulsiveness of young blacks. One newspaper opined that reform will come from neither white nor Negro agitators, but from those who will keep their feet solid on the ground and their heads cool and objective. All of this, the overt and violent reaction, the subtle, quiet condemnation, the serious and complicit call for calm, all of this because some were
just sitting.
When you hear, as we have heard in this past year, as we have heard in this past month, as we have heard in this past week, the criticizing of certain acts of protest as failing to meet someone's personal standard of appropriateness, please keep this history in mind. The implication may be, I agree with your cause, just not your method. In truth, the reality often is, I'm more concerned about order than I am about injustice. I'm more concerned about what you did than I am about what you're trying to call attention to. I'm more concerned to protect what I like than to understand why you felt the need to disrupt it. I'm more concerned about the language you used, the words you chose, the terms I don't like, because even without listening, I'm absolutely certain they couldn't possibly apply to me, than I am about the social situation that you are trying to describe. You remember what Martin Luther King Jr. wrote from that jail cell in Birmingham to his white detractors? You deplore the demonstrations taking place in Birmingham, but your statement, I'm sorry to say, fails to express a similar concern for the conditions that brought about the demonstrations. King decries the white moderates, the white moderates, who paternalistically, he says, believe he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who live by a mythic concept of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait for a more convenient season. Lamentably, he recognizes it is an historical fact that privileged groups seldom give up their privileges voluntarily. Thus it has ever been. Whenever the system of supremacy has felt threatened by any action, it has been dismissed as too controversial, too radical, too unrealistic. Those engaging in all forms of protest, from the demure to the demonstrative, have been called too angry, too divisive, too naive or idealistic, too strident or insensitive or demanding. Where threats to the fixed social order of things are concerned, it's always the wrong time, wrong method, wrong forum, wrong venue, in which not enough respect is being given to the flag, the troops, the government, the police, the moms, or the apple pies. Michael Harriet has written a satirically serious article he titled, How to Protest Without Offending White People. Harriet explains, you can object to inequality as much as you like, as long as it isn't at sporting events. No one wants to think about politics at sporting events. Or at political rallies. Or inaugurations. Or on social media. Or at schools. Or at actual protests. Everywhere else is fine. And God forbid there should be any violence or what is called violence, whether it's really violence or not. Angela Davis, recognizing, placing the question of violence at the forefront, almost inevitably, serves to obscure the issues that are at the center of the struggles for justice. We readily decry violence and discredit any protest that is not completely peaceful. But let me ask you this. Have you ever heard a police chief ask? Have you ever heard a police chief ask if they were completely committed to nonviolence? You ever heard a prison warden ask if they were completely committed to nonviolence? You ever heard anyone in the military ask if they were completely committed to nonviolence? Angela Davis insists questions about the validity of violence should be directed to the institutions that have a monopoly on violence. The police, the prisons, the military. To borrow Michael Harriet's satirical instructions, there are only two forbidden forms of protest: violent and nonviolent. Everything else is fine. What if, instead of judging, critiquing, questioning, dismissing, or ignoring all the ways that people are pointing up racial injustice, we were to want to join in? What if we were to become so committed to real transformation that we wanted to find a way to engage? In these tumultuous times, Day's offering indisputable proof that white supremacy is still very alive and quite well. Some say, I'm not physically or emotionally able to march. Some say, I'm not comfortable being out there. Some say, I don't feel safe in the streets. My response may surprise some of you. That's fine. Marching and protesting in the streets is not required. We must stop aggrandizing that act and those who engage in it as the ultimate or optimal way to express one's concerns about racial injustice. If you can't or won't march, protest, walk, or shout, would you consider just sitting? Ask those four young college guys about the power of sitting. Ask Sister Rosa about the power of sitting. Sometimes there's power, such great power, even transformative power, in just sitting. In the wrong place at the right time. Just sitting. Not to hold forth. Not to prove our liberal credentials or regale a group with our revolutionary resume. Not to create our next Facebook photo op. Sitting. As an ally, as an advocate, to listen with respect, to listen in the hopes of understanding more deeply that which, for those of us in the dominant culture, we find so very hard to understand. Just sitting to pen an editorial, a letter to the editor, a simple Facebook post, admitting our own complicity. Acknowledging our own privilege, confessing our own captivity to a status quo. Just sitting with family, with friends, at parties, dinner tables, office gatherings, not in proud demonstration of how progressive we are, but to ask honestly and seriously and probingly, what is it in us? What is it among us that resists real transformation? Just sitting, turning off Netflix, and distinctly biased news reporting, and perhaps even the NFL, and taking time to read hard stuff, the things that don't confirm our standing as the good white people, but instead call us to our own need for transformation. Just sitting, perhaps, while an anthem is being played, not in disrespect, but in deep respect for what it actually means to profess the ideal of liberty and justice for all. Just sitting in a courtroom in support of a local activist, signaling simply by where you sit your white body, signaling to the principalities of our police state and to the powers of our prison industrial complex that folks who look like you really do care. These acts will most assuredly not feel completely comfortable. Some will almost certainly ask, are you sitting with them? Do you know what they say? Haven't you heard the kind of outrageous things they are calling for? Don't you know how they've acted? The language they've used? Are you aware who they have upset? Some will almost certainly say, what you are doing, it's the wrong time, the wrong place, the wrong tone, the wrong leader, the wrong message, the wrong all. Sometimes even just sitting.